The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast, germs. Yes, we're devoting the pod to the bacterial nasties lurking in our homes. How many of them are truly dangerous? And it's one of the major killers in the world, but could a vaccine for diarrhea be around the corner? All that plus bat fellatio, helicopters on whales, and whether slime moles should be controlling our transport networks. This is a filthy, dirty edition of Science Weekly from The Guardian. Hello everyone, we're joined in the pod today by The Guardian's Ian Sample. You were ready to talk about dirty, filthy things?
Absolutely, yeah, always.
Okay, and a big welcome also to Ian Henderson, Professor of Microbial Biology at the University of Birmingham. Ian, welcome.
Hi.
Right, Ian Henderson, let's start with you. You're an expert in, I want to say, diarrhea. This is not quite true, but let's start with that particular subject. Diarrhea is something, in some cases, a hilarious sort of thing that happens to people and it's kind of unpleasant. But what is it? What's biologically going on?
Well, I suppose we've all experienced episodes of Montezuma's Revenge or Deli Belly or whatever you want to call it. But basically what diarrhea is, a accumulation of water in your intestines that just washes everything out.
And it needs to get out as quickly as possible.
Yeah, so there's basically two things that can happen within your intestine. That's one, you lack the ability to absorb water, or you actually have an efflux of water from your body into your intestine, and that makes everything in there a little bit liquid and loose, and it falls out the bottom.
And it's caused by what, bacteria?
It can be caused by a variety of things, including chemicals, but viruses and bacteria and parasites, quite common.
And for people in the Western world, it's an inconvenience, sure, but it's not a killer. But it's a huge killer in the developing world. What is it about it that kills people?
It's mostly the dehydration that's associated with getting diarrhea, the inability to replace the fluids there into the body. You know, to put it in perspective, there's about 16 billion episodes of diarrhea in a given year, and about 2.5 billion of those will occur in children under the age of 5, and that results in about 2.5 million deaths each year.
So 2.5 million people die every year.
Children under five die
every year. And is it something that can be easily treated?
There has been tremendous progress if you take the last 20 years. The WHO, the World Health Organization, has moved from a position where we had about 5 million children dying each year to the current of about 2.5 million simply just by oral rehydration therapy. But there still needs to be a move towards prevention rather than treatment.
And so this is where your work comes in. You're a biologist. Part of your work involves sequencing bacteria, the E. coli one in particular. Tell us a bit about that and how it sort of fits into this puzzle of treating diarrhea.
There's a number of restricted bacteria that cause diarrheal disease. The biggest ones are probably Salmonella typhi, about 21 million cases a year, Shigella, which is about 160 million cases a year, and E. coli, specifically one group of them, which is about 850 million cases a year. Our interest is in all three organisms, sequencing the genomes to find out what's within those bacteria that allows them to cause diarrhea.
And so the sequencing is you want to identify targets in the genetic code for vaccines or drugs that might sort of halt the progress or division of the bacterium. Is that the idea?
Yeah, so the idea is we would find common targets among the bacteria that cause diarrhea that we may be able to develop, for want of a better word, new antibiotics to kill them off without affecting the normal E. coli that grows in your gut. There's also looking at other components of bacteria that we can use for developing vaccines. So using Benjamin Franklin's phrase, an ounce of prevention is better than a pound of cure. So let's get a vaccine together rather than
Ian Sample, why don't you come in with your...
What I'm keen to understand is what it is about these microbes that actually cause this, either the water to go into the intestine or for the water not to be absorbed when it's there. What is actually the mechanism that's going on? I mean, you can say that the intestine can't absorb it, or that the intestine gets kind of an influx of water and so that's expelled. But I don't really get why that happens, because a toxin is released somewhere in the gut.
Well, within the group or the species of E. coli, there's a variety of different what we call pathovars that cause different clinical manifestations. So enterotoxigenic E. coli, which is the one that we associate most disease with, produces a toxin. That toxin gets inside the cells and changes the chemistry within that cell so that it actually secretes water into the intestine.
The infected cells are actually in the gut wall cells and things like that? Or is it more widespread than that?
No, so for enterotoxigenic E. coli, it stays in the intestines itself.
This is a lot of water that you're getting. So is it because so many cells get infected?
That's exactly it. So many cells get infected. There was a study, which I think is interesting, done by Gordon Dugan at the Sanger Centre several years ago, where they fed cholera toxin to some volunteers to see how much stool that they would elaborate. I think that the highest value is 48 litres in a 48-hour period.
Wow.
So that's a lot of
stool. Is that what scientists call it, elaborating stools?
I believe so.
That's beautiful. How close are we to actually having, as you say, a preventative for E. coli-based diarrhea? I mean, is there a vaccine on the way? Have you got trials or tests or leads?
Yeah, there is indeed. There's a variety of different people and different companies around the world looking for a vaccine towards enterotoxigenic E. coli. And it's important to make that distinction because there isn't a vaccine for many of the other types of E. coli diarrhea. So there is a live attenuated one that's going now into phase 3 clinical trials that will hopefully offer some hope for prevention.
And how does this, we didn't talk about this right at the beginning, but how does E. coli get into the gut in the first place? Is it contaminated water or food, or is it unhygienic conditions?
It's contaminated water and food. You wash your food with dirty water, eating raw vegetables that have been washed with contaminated water.
And so when your work's been on E. coli, but you mentioned some other bacteria and some other bugs that are involved in this. I mean, is there a concerted effort amongst scientists to be looking for vaccines for all these things?
There is definitely efforts to look for vaccines for all of these things, but we would feel that these are neglected infectious diseases. There isn't a commercial need necessarily to find vaccines for organisms such as Salmonella or Shigella.
So how does this stuff get funded then?
Through the generosity of charitable agencies such as the Gates Foundation, the BBSRC and the Medical Research Council and the
Wellcome Trust and places like that. So, but how would that translate itself into a pharmaceutical or a vaccine? Because obviously that requires money for trials and production and manufacturing.
So the same organism that actually kills all these children, the ETEC or enterotoxigenic E. coli, is actually the main cause of traveller's diarrhoea. So you have about 10 million cases a year of traveller's diarrhoea, and that will increase with global travel. And so that's a potential market to market a vaccine against. But also that same organism is a big burden in the agricultural community. It causes scours in cattle and diarrhoea in piglets. And so there's potential there into sort of agricultural vaccines as well.
I'm just interested in how a vaccine against these kinds of things might work. Because if you think about diseases caused by viruses, you can create a vaccine by injecting a sort of a dead or an attenuated, like a weakened virus. So the immune system goes and attacks the real virus when it comes along. But when it comes to things like E. coli, how does the process work? Are you tapping into the immune system to attack pathogenic and problematic E. coli? And how does this process work in the case of a bacterium you're targeting?
So that's a very good question. And this is where the genome sequencing sort of comes in, is because what we would like to do is sequence lots of these strains and also sequence the ones that live in our guts normally, the commensal E. coli, and find out what the differences are between them. And that way, if you can target those differences to make a vaccine that will use the immune system to kill off the pathogenic bacteria, but not the non-pathogenic ones.
Okay, well, we'll leave that there. Ian Henderson's lecture, Genome Sequencing, The Genetics of Diarrhea, is on tomorrow night, that's Tuesday, 5th of October, in Birmingham, and all the details are at thinktank.ac.uk. Ian's going to stay with us as we look through the news this week. Talking of which, this week the big news has been all about the Ig Nobel Prizes. And as you're listening to this on Monday, probably you'll have heard the first of the actual Nobel Prizes being announced. But last week was all about the Igs. Ian, give us a quick rundown of what the Igs are about before we go into some of the choice descriptions.
Well, this is a sort of fabulous exercise in irreverence whereby researchers are honoured a week before the official Nobels are handed out. The researchers are honoured for work that makes people laugh first and think later. So these are actually serious studies, but when you first hear about them, you often wouldn't have thought so.
Now, these are usually peer-reviewed, published in papers.
Yeah, they're peer-reviewed papers, they're official reports. Most often than not, they're peer-reviewed papers. And it's run out of Harvard University by Mark Abrahams, who's the editor of the Annals of Improbable Research. It's really a fun event. I mean, they go to town out there. They have theatre and sort of shows and all sorts of things. It's bacteria, incidentally, was the theme this year. And people travel from far and wide, from countries all over the world, to go and pick up their Ig Nobel Awards at their own expense, and real Nobel laureates hand them out.
Sounds like good fun. So what was the was it a good year for Britain this year?
It was our record-breaking year for Britain this year. I mean, we won four. It's the most, as far as I'm aware, it's the most we've ever won in a single year. Yeah, something like that. So we've done exceptionally well at novelty stroke quirky research. They have a lot of prizes. I mean, they don't mimic particularly the official Nobels where you have medicine, chemistry, physics, biology, you know, peace and such like. So they have some kind of more quirky ones than that. We have a transport prize this year and a public health prize and the management prize
and
so on.
You just invented a biology prize for the Nobels, Ian.
I did, sorry. Physiology and medicine. Physiology and medicine.
Okay, well, go through the top British one then.
Well, it's hard to choose a favourite that isn't...
You know you want to talk about bat fellatio.
I really want to talk about it, but I'm hesitating, and I shouldn't do, because this is half of the problem. A researcher at Bristol University with some of his collaborators in China won the Ig Nobel Prize for Biology for the first scientific documentation of fellatio in a non-human adult animal. And in this case, it was fruit bats. I was having a quick sort of discussion with him by email, and he said he was going to demonstrate how the fruit bats do this using puppets on stage. Because interestingly, you look at the research paper, what they were looking at was whether if a female fellated the male while she was copulating, copulation went on for longer. You can imagine why you might need puppets to show how this is possible. I just suspect that they're small and have bendy backs or something like that. But I was reading the paper and it's a bit of a marmalade dropper, as they say. But fascinating research nonetheless. This does speak a little bit to the issue that was raised by Franz de Waal in Huffington Post when he wrote about this study. I mean, his quote is, "The fellatio story on bats is a bright spot in an otherwise miserable record that denies animals the pleasure principle, homosexuality, and other forms of non-reproductive sex." His argument was that we have a science of human sexuality now and human sexual behaviour. And for animals, apart from everybody sort of being a bit sort of jaw agape at bonobos, there hasn't really been a very sensible or very extensive research on animal sexuality. And well, that's an interesting...
I was quite surprised this happened in bats. You would have thought it was going to be bonobos or chimps or something like that. It wouldn't be so surprising if that was the case. I mean, surely for pleasure and all sorts of other things like that, you need some sort of cognitive ability. You can't... I'm not even going to go into this.
Are you the exception to that rule?
I'm purely instinctual. Ian, hit me with another one.
Another one I really liked, and Brits were among the winners of the group that were awarded the Ig Nobel for Transportation, the Transportation Prize. And this was Mark Fricker and Dan Beber at Oxford University working with Japanese scientists. And they had used fantastic single organism slime mold to model efficient railway networks. You might remember a while back there was an Ig Nobel Prize awarded to the Japanese group for using slime mold to negotiate a maze, essentially. You basically put food one end and food the other end, and the organism just grows until it finds the food, and then all of the kind of wrong turns it's taken get kind of cut back, a bit like growing neurons in the brain. They sort of make all sorts of connections, and then they're cut back, and you end up with the sort of structure you have eventually. So with this study, they essentially use oats on a large petri dish and sort of put the oats where the cities would be, and then let the slime mold grow, and it joins up the oats, which would be your sort of transport hubs. It'd be your Birmingham, London, Cardiff, you know, Newcastle, all these sorts of places, and then any sort of inefficiencies in that are trimmed back. The structure that the slime mold produces has similarities to the railway network that we have generated after spending years of getting it wrong and doing, you know, evolutions of this and using our brains to work it out. And you think about a slime mold, it doesn't appear to have a brain or particularly a nervous system, and it makes its decisions wherever it goes. It makes them very locally. And there's some interesting stuff you can kind of, rules you can take from how it works this stuff out and then use that to actually influence how we would go and design things in the future.
I'd like to see a government report that cites slime molds as its reason for having particular sort of network of trains or something in Norwich or whatever.
But you think this is a single cell? I mean, this is an enormous
cell. No, slime molds are interesting for lots of other reasons too. And I mean, there's no end of fascination of what they do. I'm not anti that.
But it's interesting. You think, okay, how does it get information from one end to the other? How does it know? Okay, so it finds food randomly, but then how does it know what to change? And it also builds in redundancy, because any railway network is useless if you block off one part of it, then the rest of it falls down. And these networks that the slime mold was making had that kind of resilience as well. So it could take knocks. I mean, I think it's really interesting. And it moves information around within itself by sort of pulsating its sort of cytoplasm, if you like. I think the whole thing's just an extraordinarily interesting bit of science.
Okay. Ian Henderson, you've had a look at a couple of the list of Ig Nobels. I mean, hopefully one day you'll win one yourself. But what caught your eye?
I think for me, the fascinating one is definitely me flying the mini helicopters over whales' blowholes to find out what the microbiology of the whale blowhole is.
So this is the biology prize.
The engineering prize.
The engineering prize. So the idea is that you would fly a Petri dish attached to a remote control helicopter over the blowhole of a whale, because these poor buggers, they need to know what's wrong with them sometimes, or what kind of gut flora fauna is up there.
Absolutely. Maybe this is put a stop to the Japanese
research. Yeah,
absolutely. I was going, maybe this is one more hole in the reasoning of the Japanese killing whales for research.
Yeah, we can. It's a very good point, actually, because if you think, I mean, these whales must be incredibly hard to test for sort of, you know, bacteria and pathogens that they're carrying while they're at sea. And the idea that you just go and blast them and haul them on board and check them, it's sort of a bit sort of defeating the object of saving them. Whereas this sort of lovely, if surely a little impractical, idea of...
Impractical, you know, just they did it.
Flying over the top of... They have got some amazing photos of the helicopter.
There's nothing impractical if they finished it.
They've got amazing photos of the helicopter hovering over a whale as it's basically discharging its blowhole. And all the liquid obviously just goes splat onto the bottom of the helicopter. Presumably doesn't knock it out the sky. And it sticks to the Petri dish. You can then fly it back onto your boat, analyse what's stuck there, and see if it's healthy or not.
I love it. My favourite one has to be, it's a sort of almost philosophical question, this one. It's the chemistry prize. There was a study which I think BP engineers might have been involved in, overturning the idea that water and oil don't mix. I'm not sure what the actual result ended up being, but it overturns all of science. I mean, science just keeps changing. It just doesn't stay still, does it? Talking... on a more serious note, we're going to go back to funding, science funding cuts. The Ig Nobels give us a bit of a laugh, and sometimes I think people like to use them as examples of why on earth do we fund this stuff? Because, you know, why on earth do we fund this stuff when you know, especially now when there's going to be an austerity drive and there are all sorts of cuts on the horizon. And we did a story last week looking at scientists who are already leaving the UK or thinking about leaving because of the possibly 25% cuts that might happen to research budgets and the fact that we're going to possibly lose a generation of scientists. I mean, Ian Henderson, as someone working right at the coalface or the bacteria face, do you lose sleep at night about the fact that we might not have a whole generation of researchers left if the cuts go ahead as planned?
At the moment, I don't think there's, you know, losing sleep is not the right time. Wait till we see what the cuts actually are before we lose sleep or plan the next move.
But are you concerned about the way that the government's being advised? Or, I mean, are there any concerns amongst sort of scientists at the moment?
There's a huge amount of concern. I mean, and certainly the rhetoric that's coming from the government about the quality of British science, we've got to do more with less. We actually already do more with less than our competing countries. Mm. In an era when they're increasing their research budgets and we're making ours smaller, it would be very difficult to hang on to
it
good
just
scientists.
It steepens the slope, doesn't it? If the America's investing billions of dollars, which it is doing, as part of its fiscal stimulus in science, and we're not, then why wouldn't a researcher just move across the Atlantic?
I think it's already happening. I think you will see people leaving the country. And, of course, it's more difficult to attract people to come to the country. And, of course, science is a very global enterprise. The other problem with science in this country is the immigration restrictions that have been brought in.
Ian, paint us a picture of what will happen to departments like yours and those across the country if the sort of worst case scenario, 25-30% cuts in the Research Council budgets actually come to pass in the spending review in October?
Well, the simple fact is a 25-30% cut would mean that no grants get funded in the coming year. There would be no money to fund new research.
I mean, this is projects, no new projects at all.
No new projects.
And with no end in sight as to when that money might come back.
I mean, what people don't realise is much of the Research Council budget is already committed to extant projects, existing projects and capital infrastructure.
And on a very few universities as well. It's already very competitive.
It's already extremely competitive. I mean, there's only, one in five grants are funded. To cut that even further, it will really hit UK science.
I was just going to say something that came out of interviews I was doing last week with vice chancellors of some of the Russell Group, the sort of research intensive universities in the UK, was that the system is already under an awful lot of stress because of things like changes to tax rates, the immigration restrictions that you were talking about, Ian, but also the weak pound. One vice chancellor I was speaking to was saying that he was trying to recruit someone from Australia. And although, while 18 months ago the salaries would have been almost a parity, now there's about a 40% difference. And you have to think, well, how is someone going to come from Australia to the UK and suffer that much of a change in their quality of life, purely financially, let alone the fact that they're probably coming from somewhere lovely in Australia to somewhere not so lovely in the UK? It becomes immediately very hard to be competitive. And then if you add another stress on this about you don't know what the future of science is going to be like in this country, becomes incredibly difficult.
Okay, well, for everything you need to know on this story and others, go to guardian.co.uk/science. Staying with our theme of germs, Anthony Hilton is a reader in microbiology at Aston University. He came to prominence on BBC Three's Grime Scene Investigation in 2006, and since then has been trying to find novel ways to wise people up on the germs that surround them. Nell Bowes spoke to him last week and started by asking, what prompted his desire to educate the public on germs?
Many of the general public don't really have a perception of what microbes are because they can't really come into microbiology laboratories. They can imagine, you know, what a policeman does because they see him on the street, or they can even imagine what somebody in the clergy does because they can go to whatever church and go inside. But when you think of a microbiologist, they can't really come into our laboratories and understand what we do. So they have a very limited perception, I think, of what microbes and what scientists that work with microbes do. So this opportunity was actually to take a laboratory out to the people, and we kitted out a big articulated lorry, set it up as a microbiology laboratory, and we did some microbiology in people's homes and just revealed to them what was living on them and in them and around them. And that really started an interest for me in, well, how can I actually keep this alive and keep it going? So I started to look for other opportunities to work with school kids and things like that.
Do you think people are not aware of what's in their surroundings and that they should be more aware?
I think that's right. I mean, there are sort of two answers to that, really, is that, yes, I don't think people are aware of exactly what is in their surroundings, but I also think that they have a very biased opinion about what might be there, that they think that all microbes that are there are going to be bad and that they should all therefore be killed. But what we're starting to realise is that many of the interactions we have with microbes are beneficial, and therefore we need to think about a more targeted approach to our relationship with microbes and a better knowledge that not all microbes are bad. Some should actually be encouraged or left alone, I suppose, whilst others, which are potentially harmful and the sort of pathogenic microbes, that they ought to be avoided or killed if possible.
So journalists always want to compare things to a toilet seat, but what should we really be aware of as germ-ridden places around in our everyday lives?
If we were to try and rank the places and things and activities, I suppose, as well, that are most likely to be contaminated or most likely to bring harmful microbes into the home, then I think that the top one would have to be the hands. Not only the hands, but also hand contact surfaces, so sort of doors and switches and other things that we might touch. The hands can become contaminated by handling, for example, raw meat, which I think people are becoming increasingly aware of. I mean, when we think about sort of poultry, about 65% of poultry on retail sale contains Campylobacter, which is the number one cause of bacterial food poisoning in the UK. And maybe about 10% contains Salmonella. If we look at it in terms of a pure risk, that in the number of people in the UK and the amount of people that eat poultry, about one in every 25 households preparing a meal every day will actually have that hazard in their kitchen. So it brings it home that the relative risk that there is. So if you've then handled that meat in preparing it, for example, for your family, and you've opened a cupboard door or done a light switch without washing your hands, that then becomes a secondary important place where you could imagine another member of your family may open the same cupboard door or touch the same switch. Now their hands are contaminated. So it's really thinking about the hands as one of the very tactile parts of our bodies and all the places that they touch. And then secondary to that is probably food preparation surfaces like chopping boards and other cleaning materials like dishcloths and things like that. Those are really where the hazards lie within our homes. I mean, yes, the toilet is microbiologically contaminated, but that's almost what it was designed for, really, to help humans dispose of waste in that respect. And therefore, to compare everything to it is rather unusual. The same is true of dustbins and things like that. They're there for a purpose, and you treat them with that respect. But when you see a chopping board or a dishcloth, I could imagine that one moment you might wipe up a bit of spilled juice off some meat, for example, which now becomes contaminated, and then your children walk in the kitchen with chocolate all over the face. There's sort of a temptation is just to use it, isn't it? And you can see there the link between the source and potential illness.
So I'm sure you've come across the kind of troop of people who would say, why should I wash my hands when I've left the tube? Surely a bit of dirt is no problem. Doesn't it help me build up resistance?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very commonly held hypothesis, really. And it's kind of derived from what was originally referred to as the hygiene hypothesis. And it's also sort of vested a little bit in sort of folklore. I mean, many grannies would say to them, oh, a peck of dirt does you good and things like that. The situation is, there's really no evidence that if somebody is continually ill that they have a better immune system than somebody that isn't. And therefore, this idea that you have to be ill in order to have a healthy immune system is not really justified. Having said that, there is evidence that exposure to microbes, and in particular, the most recent thought on that is actually helminths. So these are worms rather than bacteria. That those interactions with those organisms can actually present the immune system with some benefit. But you've got to take that against the backdrop that if you expose yourself to pathogenic organisms, you're going to be ill. So the idea is rather ill-founded and probably ill-advised to sort of disregard hygiene, because you're really taking a risk of that. Well, how do you know that the organisms you're exposing you to aren't going to make you unwell when there's no evidence that it's going to be of any benefit? But what we do know is that when people are ill, there can be some quite serious complications and long-term complications. So my advice would be to take hygiene seriously, particularly in those circumstances where we know that it's important. For example, when the hands are contaminated with organisms that could make us ill.
So we've talked about contamination of hands or surfaces or things outside the body, but presumably you do quite a lot of work on microbes within the body as well.
Well, it's an interesting concept that there are actually more microbes sort of within our body than there are actually human cells. There are probably the best part of 10 trillion bacterial cells, predominantly in the gut, but also mainly on the skin and things like that. And they sort of outweigh the human cells by a factor of about 10 to 1. So that there is a very big interest in what is calling the microbiome, which is trying to see this sort of almost colony of microbes as being a very beneficial relationship that is established between humans and microbes over hundreds of thousands of years of evolution. And that some people are even sort of putting out the idea that it's actually a separate organ of the body that is actually doing an awful lot for us. It produces vitamins, it helps detoxify certain elements, it helps us digest our food. And in that, when you start thinking about it, that it's functioning almost like a liver or a kidney, or, you know, which we are quite happy to have in our bodies, but we want to get rid of the microbes. But it's almost this sort of symbiotic relationship that's developed. And that is very much coming forward now with the microbiome project.
And has that led to, is that the source of the current craze for Yakult and for all the friendly bacteria?
Yeah, there's a school of thought that the gut has to be occupied with microbes in order to protect it from others that actually might make us unwell. And this is a sort of concept that is referred to as competitive exclusion. The way to consider it is that if you imagine that a harmful microbe was like a car trying to find a car parking space in an otherwise empty car park, it would just park, essentially bind to the gut and therefore make you ill. Whereas if you imagine the scenario again, but yet the car park is completely full, every parking space is taken, then the car wanders around aimlessly and eventually leaves, and that's essentially what happens to the harmful microbe. It can't bind to the gut, and therefore it can't initiate a gut infection, like Salmonella, for example. So this idea of out-competing pathogens by having a good, healthy number of organisms in the gut is one strategy. The other thing that these products can potentially deliver is that the organism that is predominantly in these is called Lactobacillus. Mm-hmm. And Lactobacillus produces lactic acid as a result of its metabolism, and that keeps the pH of the gut low. And what we know about individuals with a low gut pH is that they tend to be more resistant to the establishment of gut infections. But of course, the key problem has always been that you're taking that orally, and it's got to pass through the acidity of the stomach first. And therefore, these microorganisms, how many are actually viable and delivered to the gut lower down where they need to be, is still, I think, subject to some debate.
Can you tell us a bit about what you're doing in the lab at the moment? What are you working on?
We're quite interested in the incidence of MRSA in hospitals. And one of my particular interests is in genetically fingerprinting microorganisms in the same way as a forensic scientist would fingerprint samples taken from a scenes of crime and try and piece that evidence together to try and work out what might have happened. Then in the same way, as a microbiologist, I take samples of bacteria from an infected wound, from a hospital ward, from the hands of a clinician or a piece of equipment. And by genetically fingerprinting the organisms along that potential route of transmission, I can say whether that actually was what happened or not. And that helps people implement control strategies so they know where to clean and where the critical points are.
Anthony Hilton there talking to Nell Bowes. That's it from us this week. Thanks to Ian Henderson. His lecture in Birmingham's tomorrow. And remember, you can get all the details at thinktank.ac.uk. Thanks also to Ian Sample. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. And remember, there's lots of debate and discussion also going on at our new science blogs. That's guardian.co.uk/scienceblogs. This podcast was produced by Ian Chambers. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.